Learned that trick from Vietnam. What was I just going to say that I was going to start with? This is
how,
weird.
How you hung your own shelves.
Oh, yeah, and they fell because we have shelves in the office with books on them.
You can see them in your frame.
I have hung my TV and books on my wall, shelves and my TV.
In the last three
apartments. And out of those six times that I've hung heavy things on the wall, one of them fell. So that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's not bad.
I was surprised that my TV never fell. I think I found a stud, but I think I used just strong wall anchors for my bookshelves. And then in the middle of the night, it was insane, man. I had like these, I had like this glass, like light booth little ornament thing. And like these owls, porcelain owls from like Korea that I got from when I visited my sister there in the middle of the night, like dead, like it was like 2:30 in the morning. These long shelves fell in my when I was in Brooklyn, and just it was horrendous. It was horrifying. I thought I woke up.
Did you think it was like an earthquake?
I thought it was someone busting in my apartment. And then I realized what happened, but my heart was racing because I was just dead asleep. And then I was like, oh. And then I heard people in the hallway like opening their doors. And they're like, what the was that?
You should open your door and be like, who's making all this noise?
Yeah. I was going to go out and say everything's all right, but I kind of was just frozen because I was so startled. And I just literally kind of just hid and ashamed in my apartment. And they're like, what just happened? There's only one or two people who came out. And then I was just like, well, they're going to go back to bed.
It sounded insane. Did it rip out like the drywall?
Just a little bit. I mean, really, it was just the things fell and everything fell off of it. And there was like heavy books and some things that made loud breaking sounds.
Did you, I have one more question. Did you clean it up when it fell or did you go back to bed?
That's a good question. I don't know if I remember.
I would have 100% gone back to bed.
I think I made sure that everything was okay. Also, these shelves were right over the TV, which was also mounted in the wall because, you know, again, Brooklyn studio, you don't have room for like an entertainment center.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Anyways, it worked out.
Nice.
So what you been working on?
Let's see. I've been doing a few different things. I've been doing some ember work with building like, on embermap.com, getting switching us over to username and password based logged in.
Nice.
So when we started, we kind of copied Medium's flow, which was, you know, magic email link. I think Slack had done something similar, and we really liked that. But now the sort of password managers are kind of ubiquitous. They're really good. They work great on mobile devices.
It's crazy how far it's come in the last like 2 years because EmberMap's only been around for 2 years.
Yeah.
But like back then it was no brainer. It was like, wow, passwords suck.
Yep.
And, you know, yeah. Medium does this awesome thing where you never need a password. It's the best thing ever.
Yeah. So building that was great, but now it's a pain in the ass because you want to log in on your phone and it's like, you got to enter your email address, got to go to your email client, got to click a link. It's just versus like just clicking that iOS.
Beautiful
fill,
blue button.
Fill password button. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So getting that set up, which has been a lot of work on the UI side. It's interesting. We're kind of running into a spot where we have these UI components like buttons and forms and all this. But when it comes to implementing something like a login form, this is like a form that pops up in a modal. We don't really have that anywhere. We do in some places, but we don't have like
abstraction broke down.
Yeah. Yeah. So
how did it break down?
Well, I the margins look a little off when they're inside the modal. So I want to go like customize it. And I open up the UI components and I'm like, oh, okay, I'll add some new variant to the button. And as I did this, I was like, wow, there's a lot of button variants here.
Yeah.
I counted them. We have 30 variants.
Really?
For our button. Yeah. Now some of these things, some of the variants are just like uppercase.
Right.
And it takes whatever text you put in the button and just ensures that it gets uppercase.
Right.
So they those sort of things compose well. But then we have these other variants that are like brand. And they take like they make the color of the button right, the borders right, the spacing right. They do a whole bunch of things. And this is, I'm in a spot where
doesn't decompose at all.
Decompose, no. But I'm building like a new. So there's a few things here. One is like I'm building a new UI, like a login form in a modal that we don't really have. And so I need to customize some stuff, whether it's in like the form or the button. And the way I do that is by adding new variants to our components. But once I've gotten to that point, it's almost like, man, it would be easier to use Tailwind here.
Yeah, yeah.
To just use Tailwind and not even have to like, because I'm changing levels of abstraction.
Right.
So there's like this context switch, and it's like it's frustrating because it's like I just want to kind of I'm not using our UI components. I'm not using a style that already exists. I just want to create a new style, and I want like a fast way to tweak it and create it. And it's just hard to do new UI stuff.
So why not just do Tailwind?
Yeah, I think that's sort of where
when you're building something new.
When I'm building something like this, I'm starting to do that more in the Tailwind. One thing I noticed though is that there's like a bunch of threads that come out of this. One of them is we don't really have 30 variants on our button. I mean, we do in the code. There's like 30 different variants. But if you think about it, like a lot of those variants are contextual. Like we have a danger button, which is like a red button that's uppercase text that's like you're about to delete something. And it pops up inside a confirm modal and says like, are you sure? And it's like this nice red button. It's great. Communicates exactly what's going on.
Easy to use.
But it's not like a button variant. It's like a contextual button variant because you would never see that button on its own page. That button only exists for like a danger confirmation window. So the fact that like...
It's a global variant.
Yeah, the fact that it's a global variant. And then when I'm like adding a new variant, I'm kind of looking at all the other variants and thinking like, oh, could this affect this thing?
But you shouldn't be thinking about that at all.
At all. And then also too, there's like this risk now that like I add a new variant and there's a chance that I break the danger button for whatever reason. Like I add a new variant that does something with borders and
how would that break the danger button?
I add a variant.
Does the danger button use other
like,
variants?
Yeah, there's like buttons with like borders and like transparent borders and not. And so if I like start tweaking those, and this is like one of the things.
You're saying if someone were to use your new variant with a danger variant as well?
No, it's just I go in and I'm like editing the UI button.
Yeah.
And I'm just changing variants in there.
Right.
And there's a chance that it breaks.
Right.
Now I have to be like, now I have to know that this button that I'm editing is rendered on a whole bunch of other pages. So I'm adding a style to UI button. And you could say,
for example,
it's isolated. Mm-hmm. Like it's the style the variant I'm adding is isolated, but I'm like changing a global button that's used.
Yeah. And you're editing a component. Yeah.
This is one of the things that happened. We have a button that like it appends itself to a text area. So you have like not a text area, text input. Mm-hmm. So imagine like on one horizontal line, you have like a text input and then a button attached to that. So they all look like kind of like one element. Mm-hmm. I had to like change that because of something that was like setting a height on itself. There's something like it was setting a height on itself and I had to change that. Mm-hmm. And then that broke a button on another page. So this is sort of what I'm talking about.
Where you're dealing with globals.
Yeah.
In a sense to the project.
But then I don't want to, like when I'm building the login form, I don't want to be thinking about this.
You don't want to start from scratch.
No. I don't want to be thinking
about
like,
worrying about other pages.
And then I was thinking like, well, could we use like a tool like Percy that just, Percy would catch this sort of stuff, right? Because it would take screenshots of everything and let us know when they change. But that's like, that's addressing the symptom.
Yeah, exactly.
Not the problem.
Yeah.
So that's.
And the root thing here also, you shouldn't have to really think about that.
Yeah. So I think these two things, one is like there are a lot of variants for buttons, but they're mostly contextual. So the actual set of buttons that I have available to me is not 30.
Right.
Even though the API allows for 30.
Right.
The other thing is...
Well, API allows for a lot more than 30, right?
Well, yeah, combinations. Yeah. But like, yeah.
Yeah.
If I change a variant and that variant has like a border... that like a border width of two, mm-hmm. and I remove it, then I kind of have to think about like, okay, where is this used? How does this change with the other things? Yeah. So the fact that they're contextual, they're global.
I'd have to see what, I have to code with you to see how the one variant can affect the other.
Okay.
Because I'm not 100% following, but I think it's bad enough that you're even looking at it. Like you said, if it's style, you want a new button and you have to add it to a global spot and you're just making it for a one-off place or something like that.
So that's the other thing. If you were to look at all, we have like buttons everywhere in our website, but if you were to like look at a button, like the button on our email course page, this isn't like a global button. This button was made for the email course page.
This is where the tension comes in, though, because there is a, right now, a lot of the site is inconsistent.
Yeah, yes. But I don't, so this is, I don't think, if you have an inconsistent site, I don't think your programming APIs are going to get you that consistency. I think that needs to happen more upstream, because mm-hmm. the thing here is, the variants enforce consistency because mm-hmm. I have a set of variants that I can choose from, but
not if you're building new pages that aren't composed of those things.
But not only that, like I just open up the component file and I add a new variant.
Yeah.
So it's not
actually enforced.
It's not enforcing me, and it's not like, oh, I'm just going to go off and do my own thing. It's like I need a new style. I have a button and a modal.
I have a few thoughts here. First is like you could imagine. If you're working on an app that's the state of ours, which is it's inconsistent, and you're working on a design that is what you want because it's a newly designed thing, but it doesn't, the existing UI components don't accommodate it, then you just say that this is a non-UI component part of the site, and so you just are doing raw HTML and Tailwind. That's one approach.
Yep. And that's
you just say we're not part of UI components here. Maybe eventually we can extract something from here. We'll see it, something on three pages that aren't able to be built with a design system. They're built with raw stuff, and eventually we can maybe extract it back into the design system. But right now it's not, so we're not going to try to shoehorn the design components in.
Yep. There's another thing where just to kind of argue the other side, mm-hmm. when there's not a lot of variance. The UI components are amazing. So UI modal, there's like two ways to render a modal.
Right, and you wouldn't want to do that from scratch.
Yeah, I don't want to make a new modal from scratch. So UI modal is great. There's like a small modal, and there's a big modal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Those are like the two variants that I get.
Right.
And the default one is small, and it has all the responsive stuff built into it.
What about the form stuff?
The form stuff is good. So
is the behavior stuff good and styling stuff bad?
Exactly.
So that's,
but the styling stuff is easy to change inside the form. So I had to do that for this login form. I had to change some of the styling stuff. And the first thing the first thing I did, I started prop drilling. Like I had a form that was like automatically styling itself, and I needed like the margins were messy. And so I was like prop drilling a margin all the way down just to get on a label.
Right.
And you look at this, you're like, okay, I can't commit this code. This is a mess. but you can, the form stuff, you can like peel back those abstractions similar to what we do in the form series. And so there's like the escape hatch there. There's not a lot of variance. So I don't have to worry about, I don't have to worry about composing a bunch of variants to get my button to look right. And then if I tweak one of those, thinking about how that one variant that was composed with all my variants got worked for my use case, but did that one variant that was composed with other variants in other parts of the site break those other parts of the site?
Right.
So I don't have to worry about that when there's not a lot of variants. And form is a case where there's not a lot.
Right. So it's not as basically the button is worst case of this.
Yeah. I think the button is the worst case because of the variants. I think the variants are the why I feel this pain.
Right. There's a chance if we went through and refactored the site down to a set of actually consistent buttons.
Yeah.
There would be many fewer variants. Also, like the margins shouldn't be in there. We know that now, but we didn't know that when we started.
Sure. Yeah.
Another thought I had, what were you gonna say?
Just that
you're not sure.
Well, just things like modals. Yeah. I don't want to build those from scratch.
Right.
And I feel like our modal, the behavior and the styling in our modal component is really good.
Right. Interesting. Lots of thoughts in my head right now. Trying to think what my first one was going to be. I think the first point I want to say is, if we go back to like 2 or 3 years ago, the way we were styling things, tachyons was not easily customizable.
Yes.
So one of the first things we reached for was a way to have like customized UI components, which is part of what drove this. I wonder what it would look like to undo all the UI components and go to Tailwind, because at some level, the Tailwind scales offer the same constraints and flexibility that we are trying to get at with the UI components.
Yes.
So you could imagine.
Yes. Tailwind itself. Sorry to cut you off.
Yeah.
Tailwind itself has a great set of constraints.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas Tachyons was too constrained, and so you had to go outside of it a lot. Or if you did customize, it was painful. So we had to always, it was Tachyons plus X. It wasn't just a Tachyon site. Whereas we could actually just make a Tailwind site.
Yep.
It'd be interesting to think what that would look like to just go all the way back, undo all the UI components in the whole site, and then be really diligent about keeping the customized values of all the Tailwind scales minimal and only. In that way, like basically we're talking about you're in a situation where you're building a new page and you as a developer need an escape hatch, right? That's what we're talking about. So it would be interesting if like Tailwind was the primary API and the escape hatch was that. Like you need a new thing, you can just do it in Tailwind.
Yeah. The other thought I had, again, if I could snap my fingers, mm-hmm. zero cost, was like, it'd be cool if I could build all this stuff in a design tool.
And that was exactly the other thing I was thinking.
And then when I got to Ember, I wasn't trying to figure out. I wasn't trying to figure out the constraints.
Yeah.
I wasn't trying to figure out.
Because the hard part is you're doing about two things.
Yes.
And you want to just be doing one thing. And if you've ever added a feature without having to basically do anything new on the design or styling side, it's like
unbelievable. Bliss. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of there are features that we have added like that.
Yes.
And that's like, wow, these UI components are great.
Right.
And
so there's an argument.
I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater here. It's not
right.
about getting rid of UI components. It's
you could imagine it though, just because it's kind of like, what do we say in your last forms video that we just published today? It's like the preferred duplication of the wrong abstraction. And it's like now something's taking twice as long as it should or three times as long as it should.
Right.
If you were to just use Tailwind or something like that, something lower level.
Super fast. Yep.
The other side from undoing everything and going all Tailwind is to say you do the design up front and basically we have like UI components in our sketch tool or whatever. And you just, that's your constraints. Mm-hmm. And if you decide a new design needs something that's not part of UI components, then you figure out what that new UI component is, you add it and you like ideally document it in the style guide or show how it's going to be used. And then when you go to build the feature, the thing is there. That's kind of like wishful thinking.
That feels like it's too isolated. It feels like you're building a button outside of the context where that button is going to be used.
Well, if the button belongs as part of the design system, it's because it's part of the design system. If it's not, then it's fine for it to be one-off. I mean, we have one-off things all over the site that exist outside of the design system.
Yes, yes.
So not everything is in the design system.
But that's a tricky thing. We have one-off things that exist all over the site. They're not part of the design system, but oftentimes they have some behavior that's similar to some other component. Like we want it to behave like a button. So we like shoehorn it into the design system. Mm-hmm. I think that's a trap. That's like a trap we can fall into. It's basically me saying I need a new button. Okay, I'm just going to open button and add a new variant. It's like probably not something I should be doing.
Well, it's also like, why do you want to use UI button? Maybe because it has loading state and disabled state.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one great thing about UI button is
the loading spinner.
We know it can be context aware. So if it's inside a form, it does a submit thing. If you want to make it use ref to, it becomes a link to.
But maybe the problem there is that we're coupling behavior and styling.
Yes. 100%.
Same thing with the forms. And the forms in your series are unopinionated about the styling. So you could literally reuse them in any app.
Yep.
So maybe the answer is that, which is to have presenters and containers.
And whatever. I was thinking about that and I was like, okay, so then we fall back to like, do we just fall back to having components that take a class attribute with a bunch of tailwind stuff on
it? Or it just yields what it needs and doesn't render anything. You can imagine.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think off the top of my head of an API, but like you could imagine UI button as button, and then you can either render a button tag or an A link. You can do like button dot, if button dot is like you pass a task to the UI button. So it's just data. And then if like if button dot is disabled, you add like a disabled class, or you can completely cut. But then it's like you would still end up with wanting higher level. That's the thing.
Yeah, it's hard.
I don't know what the answer is. The problem, what I'm frustrated by right now, is the fact that I haven't carved out time to go back and get rid of the tachyon debt, get a nice set of tailwind defaults, look at all the UI buttons, pull the margins out. You know, we put margins on our style components, which for the record is a bad idea and you shouldn't do, because you got to define. When you're talking about building a design system, you have to say where... Who owns what? Where is the responsibility? And you look at a UI and you break it down and you want to say like, yeah, is this a panel or is this a panel with the padding? So it's nice to just say, yeah, it's just no margin, because that way you can, the caller can have more control about laying things out.
Yeah. Yep.
So I think if we remove the margins and we clean up some of that stuff, we could clean up the UI components a lot, but I still think there's some interesting questions. I think maybe with new stuff like the email course or the login or whatever, where it's like, we haven't really thought through it and we don't really know, then like just raw tailwind.
That's sort of what I'm thinking too.
It's like if the UI component doesn't work at all, you just back out of it completely. But it's like, yeah. And then we'll just see what happens there. Cause it'll be the other problems. You know?
Yeah,
it'll
be
the
other problems. I know.
And then maybe there'll be a better way to share them or something like that.
Also, once you have a few instances of the same class of problem, the refactoring becomes easier.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, you have the use cases in front of you. By the way, I think there's something about this that's important. This is like a... are you okay, by the way?
My leg fell asleep, and I am having the worst pins and needles right now. So just continue.
Okay, good. I thought we were going to have to edit that out, but I kind of like it. Your face was changing.
Yeah, you know? It is.
I was like, do you need to take a break or something? I think this is, there's this thing, right? Engineering. Let's talk about making a nested drop-down list and how to use recursion and curried actions to make this data structure work. Okay, that's like definitely engineering. Then you have like the Steve Sugar, Adam Wathen stuff, which is like design. You're like looking at a table and you're like, it's not going to work on mobile, whatever. Add a shadow, remove borders, it'll look better.
Yep.
There's this thing in between. And if you notice it, like most of the tutorials around, like whether you're looking at an Ember tutorial or React tutorial or whatever, they either just completely wave away the problem of design, of implementing a design, or they start off with a well-designed like CSS style sheet.
Yep.
But implementing design is hard.
Yeah.
It's super hard. I was just thinking about this because I was working on... when we were working on the email course, there was a lot of questions. There's a lot of ways you can do it. If you give me a Steve Sugar designed sketch file and then I go to implement it, there's a ton of ways I can do it. Like one of the things I was thinking about is I started doing this thing where I like only use margin top and just never use margin bottom.
So this way when like you add a new section, you just know. I'm dropping this thing in here and all the lever I tweak is a top margin.
Yeah, exactly. And it's fewer surprises. The margin clap stuff doesn't own you, where you have like, if this section has margin bottom 20 and this is margin top 30, there's only like 30 margin between them because of margin claps. It's just way simpler. Like you need to move something, you add like you tweak margin top and it moves. There's no surprises.
Yep.
There's other things like this too. Just how you lay things out. I'm trying to think, there was another example I had where just how I would go about doing this. Do you add like a div with a spacer, or do you do like a section with padding? Like you look at a design and let's say you had like, this is a tough one. let's say 90% of the design is container. So it's like max width 1200. Mm-hmm. And then there's part of it that goes outside of it. So like, how would an implementer think about that? You ask, people would give you different responses.
Yeah.
One, you could say like, you should have a parent wrapping the whole thing that's a container so that if you go to add a paragraph of text, 90% of the time it's going to fill within that container. So it's good that it's already being wrapped. The times where you need to go out of it is a special case. So let's make something that lets you escape from the wrapping.
Would that be like a negative margin?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's not, that's funny because that's exactly how I would not think of it.
So
I would say that you basically have two containers here. Your top container has a max width, and then you do a bottom container with no max width and a background color.
What if that thing is like in the middle though? What if that thing is like in the middle? Like what if it's like, you know, it's like text, 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 and then it's like wide, and then it's like text, text, text.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So three containers. Basically the fact that you're going wide.
But then if you don't have a wide one, you end up with one container?
Yeah.
But that's kind of weird, right?
Yeah.
Because conceptually, it's one section.
It makes her factoring super difficult.
Right.
Because actually what would happen is if you told me to remove the wide thing,
yep,
the middle thing in the, yeah, middle, I would delete it.
Yeah.
And there'd be two containers.
Yeah, that both have the same max width.
Yeah.
And then you come back and look at that, and you're like, why is this apparent?
Why are there two containers?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
Exactly. So this is the kind of stuff that's really hard. We have a panel UI component that I was playing around with one time that does this. UI panel as panel, or UI container as container. And it just, boom, does it. It gets a text right on mobile, tablet, desktop. So you can just like go to town with like P tags and title tags and it'll look good. But then you need to escape it and you can do the contextual container. You can do container.fullwidth.
Ah,
so you have, okay, UI container, all your stuff, and you just do like a UI container.fullwidth, and then you just drop in and you can do anything you want.
So you still have one parent and then this thing.
Conceptually, you're looking, yep, at the template and it's like, this is a section. It's just that this part escapes itself.
So yeah, yeah.
Just an idea.
I actually,
it's just
like,
an approach.
And I like this because you're not actually exposing the implementation there.
Right.
So, exactly. So me as a developer, I can say, hey, how do I escape? Okay, I use p.fullwidth,
exactly,
container.fullwidth, whatever it is.
Exactly.
And get out. Cool.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And this is like a pain to do if you were just doing Tailwind because if your margins change, like let's say the gutters where the padding on your container changes, and now you have to like negative margin one, medium, negative margin two, large, colon, negative margin three. And if you ever change any of those, there's a relationship between those things.
So can Tailwind take like all your margins and generate a negative version of those?
You could do a component that's a container. Actually, the container that ships with Tailwind is called a Tailwind plugin. I believe it's a plugin that provides a Tailwind component. So you could do a Tailwind component that like extends. Remember the at apply?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you could do like container, and then you could do like container escape. And that way, at least you could like look at one file and have all the rules there. So if you change like ML2, you would do like negative ML2 and change it.
Gotcha, gotcha.
So that would be like a way you could do it without Ember components. But Ember is even better, right? The API is even better because you don't have to think about it. So that would be another way to do it. But that's the kind of thing. It's like if we asked someone at Dockyard, someone at Thoughtbot, someone at Apple, someone at Netflix, given this this page, implement this. This is an area, especially for the styling stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is like an area no one talks about, I feel like.
You
can do this stuff with CSS, but that's not really what I'm getting at. It's this thing of where you need to implement a design. And of course, there's a million ways to do it. Drop downs, you know, position apps. I mean, there's just that conversation we just had. Thinking about margins as outside components, layout versus components differently, like all these things. I feel like this is the stuff that takes forever.
Yeah.
It takes forever.
Do you think the answer here is like a UI toolkit?
I think it's just like education around this niche that, and then like seeing how other people do it, just like we do with other things. It's like, how do we know to use like a scrolled into view component? It's just because people are talking about it and like talking about implementation, but like people don't really, people are like, oh yeah, I got that working, or, you know, even like the Laracast redesign, I was like listening to Jeffrey talk about that. And yeah, he was like fiddling around with some CSS. It's just like, It's the part of the job that you just grind your teeth and get through, and then you ship it and you're done. But it's not like I can tell you I'm gonna see a layout again in the future that's gonna be a fixed width thing. The gutters are gonna change on small tablet and desktop, and there's gonna be parts of that that need to escape it. What's the right, quote, right way to do that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I can tell you what I would do based on my, you know, 5 years of building this stuff or whatever, but like it also changes every time I do it. So this is another thing. Look at Apple's website. You know, it's very different. Like, there's not really containers. Like, you click the blocks and like they know their widths, kind of. They have like the image. It's just not laid out as I would do it if I were to just go back. I'm sure there's great reasons why I want to know those reasons. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yep. Do you think part of this, going back to what you said, like you grind on CSS, you grind your teeth on CSS, you fiddle with it, you get it working and you're done.
Yeah.
Where when I think of like backends I design or APIs I design, there's always like, I get it working, but then I always have like
the refactor
in the back of my head. Now it's usually not high value or high yield, so it goes to the lower priority,
right.
But I know.
But what if you knew those rules in this? What if you knew like, margin here, I need to pull this out of the component.
I guess that's my question, is like, when I fiddle with CSS and get it working, I never am thinking, I'm like, okay, I get it working, let's ship it. I'm never thinking at that, what is the next refactor?
Right. So yeah, maybe there's room for this. Also, it's just like, I feel like you're like, oh, I'm taking an Ember course. I'm taking a Vue course. I want to learn how to use Vue components. If someone's writing that course, they're just going to be doing Vue components. They're not going to be,
you teach like the Ember API or the Vue API. It's learning about how components compose and interact with each other.
But why is it not this stuff too? I mean, like if this ends up being 60% of your job because you suck at it or because it's hard and no one's teaching it.
Or it's where the time, it's where the time goes. 60% of your job. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, maybe we could do a course on it, a series on Ember Map. Just taking a layout from a popular page, you know, Apple's homepage or something with a little bit of interactivity that would show how you'd use Ember component APIs to make that stuff easier, but also like how you do this with CSS. Also like what we talked about last week, like fast booting things and being declarative, all that stuff feeds into this. Like it affects how you would think about this problem.
I mean, maybe the boundaries here are just so squiggly and not well-defined, where you have like styling and then behavior, and you're often thinking about those things at the same time. Mm-hmm.
But anyone, whether you're using Vue or React or Ember, give me some front end devs who are detail oriented from Netflix, from Apple, from Facebook. Give them a UI page, just a page, a static page, and ask how they would cut that up into their respective front end technology of choice. There's going to be enough overlap that all those people can have a conversation about how they would use components or wouldn't use components, how they would use CSS. And I think you'd learn a lot from that.
Cool.
So, I just think that the big fat secret or whatever. You know what I'm saying? It's like the big fat secret that no one talks about.
Like dirty little secret?
Yeah, dirty little secret.
Yeah, whatever, it works.
I was thinking of the elephant in the room.
Elephant in the room is
that's better. That's a good one. No, but I think a dirty little secret, I think it is a dirty little secret as well. It is an elephant in the room. Maybe it's both. It's a dirty little secret that cutting up a design into HTML and CSS is still super hard, regardless of how good the front end technology has become. And maybe a dirty little secret is like, I'm an experienced front end developer, and I just spent like 2.5 hours because this thing has like gutters on tablet and I need to escape it in this. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, that's like, that's me.
Yeah. I mean, that's me too. I mean, that happens. Like that happens.
Yep.
It's hard. It's hard stuff. So yeah, that would be interesting to like do some research and pull some people and just see how they think about it. And maybe there's some rules we can get at, for example, the margins one, which like helps you a lot in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I mean, if any listeners have any suggestions or sort of, like the margins, not putting margins in components, that's like a hard lesson that we learned. So
if
you know of something like that, if folks know of something like that, I'd love to hear from them.
Yep, definitely. Cool.
So another thing I've been dealing with is JSON API includes. So a lot of times when we make a GET request, the front end can just say, hey, give me the user, all their blog posts, all those blog post comments. And there's like a great little way of you know, formatting that request, even with like our add-on like storefront, and just makes this stuff so easy to fetch that sort of data. I've noticed that when I'm posting or patching stuff to the back end, I'm patching like a single model.
Mm-hmm.
And the back end is going to update that model,
mm-hmm.
but there might be like some attribute that changes where it also then kind of fans out and updates some other data in the database.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really have a good way of saying like, hey, update this comment and then like refetch the user. Like imagine like a user had like a static.
Or let's say a post has a comments count materialized property.
Yeah. So update this comment, make it unpublished. But then when you give me the response, like also sideload, also include the post since that had an attribute that changed.
Right.
I don't really have a good way of expressing this right now with Ember Data and JSON API.
Right.
What I've been doing is I've been hard coding these includes in the back end.
Mm.
So when you patch a comment,
mm-hmm.
it's going to respond with a post,
mm-hmm.
but it's going to respond with that comment and also sideload that post.
So in a single request response, because the problem is, let's say you patch a comment and then it comes back success. Ember Data store is going to be updated with the updated comment.
Yep.
And your UI is going to respond because Ember Data is an identity map, single source of truth for your UI. But now your UI is in an inconsistent state, because if you think about the actual source of truth for your data in the back end, the database never existed in a state where the comment was saved and the post comment count was wrong.
Yeah. So I could do something where I save the comment and then I immediately reload the post.
But
there's that
intermediate
small
state
in between.
Right.
Yeah. There's a state that's not actually reflective of the real world.
Right.
And so to solve this, I've been having the back end.
So you want within a single request response to go and then for the thing to come back. This is a great thing we were talking about, this about JSON API, is that even though you're patching a comment, if the response happens to be the updated comment but also has the post included in it, then everything's just going to work, because that whole payload is just going to, the graph is going to be read right into the Ember data store and your entire Ember app will just exist in that final state.
Yep.
It skips the intermediate state.
It's awesome. I mean, it's awesome.
It's awesome. It's just that there's no way to, there's no semantics for expressing, I want to patch this and respond with these other related resources.
Yeah.
Or so, respond with resources that might happen to change.
So I have some ideas here, like some things that would actually work, but, mm-hmm. but okay. So I've been hard coding this stuff in the back end. So you patch the comment, you get everything back that gets read in.
And that's basically saying like the back end knows,
yeah.
I know best, so I'm just going to tell you what's changed.
So this works, but it's kind of like against the way we've been building UIs. We make our UIs smarter and smarter. So if you think about a GET request, when I get comments, if I need like their authors included, I specifically have to ask for them. Mm-hmm. The back end is dumb. The back end doesn't say, oh, I know best, I'm going to automatically include mm-hmm. authors for you. The backend saying like, you're specifically not asking for authors, so I'm going to not give them to you.
So it's weird now that you're patching a comment and the backend is...
Yeah, part of me feels like a little like, oh, I'm doing something that I know I'm not... Like, that I know we've been burnt by before. And,
right.
And that all of our, you know, our 5 years
our
in
knowledge,
SPA,
yeah.
you know, has taught
experience
us...
Experience tells us.
Yeah, this might get you in trouble. But... You know, in the reality of sort of JSON API and their backend JSON API implementation and Ember Data, this is by far the easiest thing to do.
Yeah, if you had to do this, if you were working at a company, how to do this? This is what you'd do.
Yeah, I think you could do something where, like, you know, the include is a query param
mm-hmm.
that's part of the URL.
Mm-hmm.
So you could do something where you do a patch or post to a URL
mm-hmm.
with an include query param, and then the body, like the actual post body, is a JSON document to update that resource.
Right.
So I think you could do this, but there's no, you know, there's no like entry point. There's no way to tell Ember Data to do that. Like when I save this model, also add this include query string onto the URL. So you can
right.
imagine like passing like options.
Yeah,
user.save
and then options
include,
reload with or like yeah. respond with.
Yeah. Include.
Or respond include
yeah.
or something like that. Yeah.
So that was one idea, but then it's like, man, I don't I feel like I'm framework fighting when I go down those roads.
You could imagine it being an API that gets added to the framework.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Like additional data to post with.
The problem here, though, is that you had another idea? I like that. The problem is still that it actually is true that the server knows best in this case. So if you...
Yes. Yes.
I guess this is the part that's like...
Well, no, it's true. The server does know best, because if a server is going to go off and change some other model...
Yeah, now it changes the user and you didn't even know.
How can the front end possibly know that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's go to snap our finger, ideal world. Ideal world, what's the ideal world? The ideal world is actually...
The ideal world is some... I'm just cutting you off all day.
Yeah, go.
The ideal world is some distributed database where like there's some other mechanism of how data is synchronized between your
back and front. I think we're thinking the same thing. I was going to say, ideal world is you're showing post one on the screen right now, so your app is subscribed to post one. So if you patch a comment that happens to change post one, you get the updates to post one. And the tooling does it in such a way that it only gives you, like, it batches the payloads to avoid unnecessary states that are, like, impossible.
You can do, like, forks.
It's like a log. It's like a log.
You can do forks, too. Like, if I'm editing post one, I don't want to get post one updates.
Right.
Because I might be editing the body. I don't want you to overwrite that.
Right, right. So let's keep it simple. You're going far ahead.
Edge cases, bro.
Let's keep it simple. So you have post one and comment one in the store. You create comment two on the client side and you click save. Goes to the back end. Back end creates saves comment two. So you have a new log entry. And then there is another thing that basically updates a materialized view thing that updates the comment count on the post. And that's another log entry?
Yeah, that would be new log
entry. Okay. Yep. So now the client could say, I only have this log entry and now I need... you don't get all the entries because there's things that you don't care about, but somehow you can filter the log entries based on what resources you're subscribing to.
There's some browser API. It's like server sent events, but you can they have like an actual API for you can give an ID.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah, of the event I got. I've never used this, so I don't know its limitations or, you know, spots you can get in trouble. But I did look at this for a way of syncing data back and forth.
And that way you would be able to... Now, how would that work? So...
Well, you would have to... So the back end...
And if it's a request response cycle, like you still need to get those two events together and send it as a single, from the perspective of the client, needs it as a single bulk update.
Yeah. So
you don't, if you're doing request response, like it has to be part of the response, or there's a separate like event that like pushes it up.
Right. And when you think about like logs, you're probably just reading the logs like one line at a time.
Yeah.
So you would see the first update.
Yeah.
And then you would see the next update. Now you could say like...
Now couldn't the front end say I'm on log one and the latest is three and you need to go through everything up until three and only respond with the things that you're subscribed to?
Yeah, but that's tricky because a lot of times like if you're reading three, you actually don't know how long the file is. You don't know how big that... Mm-hmm. You would have to like read ahead to see what the actual size of the file. And then like, you know, there's like a... You might never catch up. There could be data that's just always being written.
Okay, so
you're reading.
Yeah, I get that. That makes sense. What about this? I think this, in this case, they wouldn't be two separate log entries because it's not actually a consistent state of the database. It would be one log entry that would be mutating both the comment two and the comment count in the post.
So that'd be, interesting. Yeah.
Because you can't get them both separately. And that was the
whole
problem.
The whole point of this is inconsistency.
Right.
So
Yeah.
You get one.
So somehow it's the back end controller action here that's saying you're creating a post. I'm going to create one log entry. That's a mutate of the state. And it's going to be both those resources changing.
Right. Yeah. This is interesting because we're saying we don't care if our databases are inconsistent and that like our front end is maybe a few seconds or a few minutes behind the back end.
Right.
We're saying the problem is when the inconsistency is an impossible state.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It can be stale, but it can't be impossible. Yeah that's a bigger problem. I mean,
Yes.
Ideally, it's not stale either, but if it's impossible, that's a real big problem.
Staleness is fine.
Yeah.
But yes.
Yeah.
But this, I mean, okay, so going back to everything, this huge problem that we've just magically solved.
Right.
this is so, so hard how you like implement this and how you share all this data. And so, yeah, having the back end just include, figure out like, okay, yeah, I'm changing all this stuff. And so I'm going to respond with this as a body of the response to your
patch. But that's actually closer to the ideal situation than anything else, because if we're saying the consumer should have the burden and it's like, oh, wait, I'm actually showing the post one here. I actually need to fetch it. So the other option, one of the things we talked about when this came up earlier this week was JSON API operations. So we're talking about that there's no real semantics for saying patch me comment two and I need to refresh these other, right? Have you ever seen, we've seen this in like lots of apps we worked on when we were new to Ember. We've seen it in consulting projects. It's just something you get into. It's like a refresh models thing where you're like,
well, I
just want to refresh everything because I know crap got stale. Like everything is in an inconsistent state. It's either like reload the page or it's just like reload the model hook because of whatever. So this is what we're talking about. Like this is something every Ember developer, every SPA developer, I can guarantee has like run into before. So we're talking about a better situation for that. So there's no semantics for expressing this right now with JSON API where you say patch comment two and then give me post one in the response. But if we had JSON API operations, the promise there is like you could actually send over an operation which has, you could send over a, what is it, a log or a pay, like a request.
It's two operations.
Yeah. One is a patch to comments two. One is a get to post one include comments. And then that would solve the problem of the inconsistent of the impossible state. It was just from the perspective of the Ember app, it's all rolled into one
state change.
But this still puts the knowledge on the burden on the consumer.
Right.
The consumer still has to know post one depends on comment two. So I think that's maybe would enable some cool things and solve some problems for sure. But for this particular problem, I think actually the ideal is closer to what we already do, which is if anything changes, ideally it's only anything that changes that you care about, but if this operation changes anything else, just sideload it with a response.
Yeah, this is interesting. So when I started this, it felt weird that I was putting this knowledge in the server because normally we have the knowledge in
dumb,
our client.
Dumb server.
Yeah, but maybe this makes sense for fetching data. Dumb server, smart client.
Right.
But maybe
maybe you
just convinced me. I mean, yeah, with
a mutation.
Smart client, smart server, dumb client, because the server, actually, at the end of the day, the server knows,
the server knows what was changed.
Yep.
Yeah, I was thinking like the analogy here is like SQL, right? Where SQL is dumb. And if you ask for one thing, it doesn't give you another. I guess there's an analog where if you create a record, it tells you the ID because it knows best about the auto incrementing ID. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's an example where, it's just where does it make sense to have the responsibility?
Yeah, that's a great point. That's really good.
And in this case, like you basically have to solve this problem of like these two things can't exist atomically. Like they are one conceptual change of the state of your system from like A to B. Mm-hmm. And it has to include all this data. So I think didn't we talk about this one time like a year ago where I had this whole design in my brain where the resource that's changed.
You can like look at everything that changed
as a log and then like
respond with
Exactly.
I think it gets really tricky.
Yeah.
I think like, cause you're like batching up and then saying like, oh, this is since your last request, we've changed all this data in the system and here. I think it gets really tricky. I think it's buildable.
Yeah.
But
let's start now.
That's doable. Default.
Yeah. Yeah.
This
would be awesome though. If this was like, this is the kind of thing that's like, I don't want to get back on this horse that we've beat to death. But if there was more constraints in, you were doing something like an Ember and a Rails and you are using JSON API, then this is the kind of thing that could come out of the box.
Yeah.
Where the kind of stuff you're building for the fast boot cache, where it's a dependency, it's keys, it busts it, because it knows the graph, depends the graph, you could do all this if you were just doing like basic CRUD modeling.
Yep.
And relationships. And you could just have this out of the box. Like it could literally work out of the box where I change something and it happens to change a derived or affected attribute on another resource, just reloads it along with it and you don't even care.
Yeah. So I wanna kind of bring this back to the server responding with data.
With a graph.
Yeah. With a graph
when you just patch a comment.
I noticed this like since doing this. This also kind of opens a door to like new patterns to do in JSON API. So there's like this JSON API problem that I always bring up. It's like the shopping cart problem. Mm-hmm. You can't build a shopping cart with JSON API.
With operations.
But you can't. Today you can't.
Today you can't. Yeah,
you can't because, you know, you have to create the shopping cart. You have to.
Yeah, you want to create a graph of data. You cannot create a graph of data right now. Right.
So if you're saying the server can respond with includes,
yeah.
this does make the shopping cart a little more approachable because you can like create a new synthetic model that just has a whole bunch of random data in it. And then the server, it's like...
But the client has two items that are unsaved. How do you get both of those over the same way in the same payload?
So you do a post, the client does a post and the client comes up with like some other API where it's like
a cart that has many items or something like that.
Yeah. So it does a post to cart.
But you can't post you can't post relationships.
Yeah. You can like hack it. You can
post keys.
So what if you did this? What if you post?
Yeah, hack it like attributes yeah. like Rails attributes. Does it. Like Rails does it.
Yeah.
When Rails serializes a form with nested models.
Exactly. So you have an attribute on your model called items and it's an array of like POJOs items. And
right.
I mean, you're probably cringing hearing this, but you can imagine this. And then the actual backend now says, okay, great. I created your shopping cart. And then here's like the actual models that got created that are included. Yeah.
But that's hacking around JSON API.
Yes.
What we're talking about is not...
It's not hacking around JSON API.
It's part of JSON API. And it actually is conceptually, semantically makes sense from my perspective. I could argue that, it's completely... You send a patch and I send back a JSON API doc. What's the requirements from the specs perspective on what's the response for a mutation? I think it's just a JSON API document. If it happens to sideload things, it's still spec compliant.
Yep.
So to me, that's totally fine. We just need better APIs to actually do that. For the shopping cart case, we need the operations, but that actually solves a problem in a way that's not hacky. You don't have like posts as an array of POJOs. You need operations for the shopping cart.
Sure.
But that's like a good solution for it.
But we don't have operations.
But we don't have all the stuff you're talking about either.
I'm saying we could post to like a synthetic model.
You're saying that something, exist. You're saying it's not actually a violation because it's not that you're adding a fake attribute to the shopping cart that's like items. It's just that you actually have a thing that's like an items property that has like an array of POJOs or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's, yeah. But if they added it would be bad.
Shopping cart is a bad example.
It's a great example.
No, but let's come up with one that's a good example for what I'm saying. So it's something like you're creating a new sign up mm-hmm. and your sign up has like
create a team or something.
Yeah. You create a user, you create a team and you create you create a purchase.
Uh-huh.
And so imagine you had like a sign up model. And the signup model had like an attribute of email, attribute of team name, and an attribute of like credit card number.
And it happens to create. Yes, that is a better example. I see what you're saying now.
So you post that and then you get back a document that's like, okay, I created your signup. I also created these.
Right.
The signup also has a relationship to a user, a team, and all this stuff.
And maybe you actually want the signup in your system. You actually want it modeled because you want to create it at and all this stuff.
Yeah. The funny thing here,
if you're doing that to get around the problem that would be solved with operations, like if you actually just want a user, a team, and a purchase created, and you don't need any other model that's related to them, and you would be able to do it, I would argue if snap my fingers, if JSON API operations existed, that would be the right way to do it.
But it doesn't.
Yeah, it doesn't right now.
I think
conceptually it is the correct.
Yes. Yeah. 100%.
But I think there's this class of problems that you're talking about, which 100%. If you're creating something,
you're responding with a
graph.
You're posting to a sign up. You actually don't care about the sign up. You care about the models that get created.
Right.
So get response with a graph of like an actual user model, an actual team model, an actual subscription model.
Right.
And then you get those in the store. And then even though
app is never in the state, it's never in a bad state.
Yes.
It doesn't exist in the server, which is
because you're able to create multiple models in one request by using attributes of a single model to represent multiple
models. But the goal is because your server is doing all this in a transaction. It's all in or all not.
Yeah.
It's like all these three models are existing in my database or they're not. That way, when you write computer properties in Ember that are like a user is signed in if they have a team, but like there's a spot where you have a user but no team, but then the second request that comes, you avoid all that stuff, which is like the goal. So
yes. Yeah.
I totally agree with that. It's just it's another instance of the general problem of this mutation that you've posted, that you've told me about, that you've requested, has affected other resources. Here's all the affected resources for the mutation.
Transaction is a really good word.
delete
there,
as
if
well.
There's some
yeah,
way
transactions.
To, if there's some
operations.
Way to, yeah.
Operations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know, but I do not like, oh, just use operations. JSON API operations because I can't.
Yeah. Also, there is something higher level here because of the case of the signup, where you're not just creating the signup model just to accommodate this problem, just to work around this, but you're creating it because it's actually a model in your system. You want signups.
But what if I don't? Like, let's just say, like, I don't.
Well, if you don't, it's operations.
Yeah, yes.
But it's totally valid to want it. Let's say you have this model where you have a signup and it points to a user and it points to a team and it points to purchase, and you want to create all of them in a transaction. Maybe you would do operations.
Yeah, I think I would. I think I would do operations because you probably don't have a sign up that points directly to a user, a team, and
you know what's weird about this is, like, I feel like we're getting into a discussion, but it's interesting to me to think about this. There's going to be some order dependency on these models. In the back end, you're going to, like, first create the user, and if it fails, blah blah, your exit. Otherwise, you'll create the team. If it fails, exit, blah blah. Otherwise, create the sign up, and now it all works.
To pull a play from your book, I think JSON API operations supports this.
No, but does that mean both the front end and the back end has to know that? Or would you just want the front end to send the minimal data? I've got an email, I've got a team name, and I've got a plan that they're purchasing. And in that case, I actually don't want to do operations because that forces knowledge on the client to say, I actually know I need to create the user first, and then this, and then this. Whereas really, I'm just from the perspective of the client, you're creating a sign up.
I see what you're saying. So, like,
what if you had to change that order in the back end, and now you have to change it? And that seems horrible.
Yeah. Good.
So okay. It seems like you actually would want to just
sign up.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Because the user's like, that's what they're doing.
So when you have a sign up.
So this is a valid use case for creating a thing and having it come back with a graph, and not using operations to solve that.
But the sign up. The signup works nice when you have just string attributes, but like when I was kind of pitching this as a shopping cart, it falls apart.
I was just thinking about that.
I'm saying, like, do POJOs.
There's a lot of stuff here, and you're like,
what if it's interesting?
Okay, if you're persisting the data in the back end in a transaction, if you happen to, let's say you have a UI that's like doing 10 things and one of them can fail, but the other 9 should go through. In that case, like, you do them a separate request or something like that.
Yes.
Shopping cart, like, you do them together.
I think it's okay that the client knows about order. It's like, because you're...
But also whether you're doing things as a transaction or not. Well, I guess it's just...
I think if it's in an operation, it's in a transaction. At least that...
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe we can look at, like, the spec.
Maybe that is it. So
that's what I would assume.
This is weird, though, because to me, like, the sign up, maybe there's ways to link the resources on the client with GUIDs, like with GUID IDs, and then they get replaced by the server.
I'm getting really excited, but yes, I think you can do that.
So you're creating a graph of objects in both cases, and so you shouldn't do something like create a sign up with, like, artificial, like, synthetic attributes, like. You're in both cases, you're just an operation. It's an operation. It's a list of operations that are, like, creating a graph. I guess that's the question. How does JSON API operations prescribe that you create a graph of related data? Is it that you create the first one, the second one, and the third one? Is it that you link them all and then you just can give me a graph of things that have keys to each other via GUIDs, and then I can do that for you? I mean, that would be pretty awesome.
Yeah,
maybe that's what the answer is.
I think the later one you just explained the graph with keys that link.
Yeah,
I've heard this concept called side posting.
I think it's the hack that
some people use to get around this, but that's what they do.
Interesting.
Seems hard.
Seems like it would also be extremely useful. Well, yes. What we've done on, like, our admin page, where you, like, reorder something, is, like, you just say, "Oh, I happen to be patching." In one tick of the run loop, I think we should do a series on this too, because this is actually solving a real world problem that developers face today. You are patching the position of, like, 10 sortable items at once. And
so you move item one item 10 to 1. And so you're
2 like through 8, 9 have to be bumped up.
So you can imagine there's 10 different patch requests that right. go on here.
And what if one fails? Yeah, it's just not, it's not.
Yeah.
It's not what you're thinking. Is it, this is one thing from the perspective of both the user and even the server is doing this as one thing. Or like, it's yeah, it's just reordering things as one conceptual thing. So you want some way to express that. It's hard. But I think it's actually not that hard. It's actually, sorry, it's, what is it? Is it like, it's not, it's simple, but it's not.
It's easy, but it's not simple.
Yeah. Yeah, it is easy. It's very, yeah, you just need a transaction, but it's just, you have to actually, someone has to do the work. Someone has to do the work. If anyone's motivated, you have my phone number. Cool. Yeah, I think that would be a good series. I've been starting to think about this as like a series we should do where it's like, it's tempting when you think about like tutorials and it's like, here's how to use a component number, whatever it is. But it's like, okay, I've got my, I'm like, you know, 6 feet into this ditch and I need some help here. Like, let's do something real.
Yeah.
What's the, you know, I was thinking Draftable.
Draftable
should be a series one, yeah. because it's just like how we would solve the problem today. The reordering thing with a run loop.
Reordering thing with a run loop would be, yeah. And that's something that you've done before.
Yep.
And it's yes. super, super elegant.
Yep.
Looks great. Draftable is funny because like you think like, oh, I want to make Draftable as a series. And the next slide is like, oh, I want to make a draftable add-on. And then
that's happening already with this nested drop-down series we just started. I'm like, wait, I shouldn't be teaching anyone this. I should just make an add-on. No one should have to think about this ever again. But part of this is like, you're going to run into new problems that are similar. And this is how we would think about it. But 100%, all of these things should be add-ons.
You're like, I don't want, the same with the forms, right?
Yeah.
I don't want people just copying the forms that I'm writing into their app.
Right.
And then not like, every app is going to have different levels of form abstraction. So if you just copy mine, you need to copy mine, but then understand what you should have inside the form and outside the
right,
form.
Right, right, right.
And so if you just copy mine and not think about that,
right.
you're going to have a bad time.
Which is why you want to lock them in with a small public API via an add-on.
Yeah, exactly. So I want to teach the concepts.
Yes.
And then I want to say the end.
Use the add-on.
Use this add-on.
Yeah.
And yeah, small public API.
Yeah.
And this is, your app should create its own API on top
right.
of that. But yeah.
It's a lot of work,
all of a sudden, a series goes from one video a week to, you know,
18 years of maintenance.
Yeah.
Cool. Should we wrap it?
Yeah, I think so.
Last week we mentioned this. What was the law that you mentioned? We were talking about communication structures.
I mentioned Metcalfe's law.
Metcalfe's.
But it's not Metcalfe's law. It's Conway's law.
We were looking at the
law.
Links and it's called Conway's law. And this, do you know how it's stated? Let me just delay while I pull this up.
I mean, since I got it right last week, I might as well
yeah.
try to get it right again.
Yeah.
I think Conway's,
see how you do.
I think Conway's law is your services will mimic your organization's communication structure.
Pretty good, pretty good. Conway's law is an adage. Is that adage?
Adage. Yeah, adage, sure.
Named after computer programmer Melvin Conway, who introduced the idea in 1967. It states that organizations which design systems are constrained to produce designs which are copies of the communication structures of these organizations. So, yeah.
It's also, you have a few jobs programming, and it's painfully true. It's so true.
What do you mean?
Just the couple of jobs of programming that I've had, it's
the services
that we build are like, oh, yeah, that does kind of act how people talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Teams like get along really well, different teams, but they get along really well, tend to have a bunch of custom API, just a custom, like, oh yeah, I'll add that for you. I'll do this for you. Like a whole bunch of just the client, like one server is just fetching data from the other server, the custom endpoint. And it's funny. It's like, well, it does work.
Yeah.
And it works great. And it works because the teams just, they get along and it's easy for them to add attributes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Thanks for joining us this week. We'll be back next week. As always, we're trying to publish these every week, Wednesday mornings. So we're trying to be consistent there. And who knows what we're going to be talking about next week?
JSON API. Hey, we didn't talk about fast food this week.
CSS. That's true. Yeah, you're the reigning fast food expert now, yeah. Practitioner. Did you do any fast food work this week? We'll find out next week.
We're not talking about fast food this week.
All right. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.